I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends in the world of contemporary poetry and poetics to collaborate on a close but not too close reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the verse to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a poem that interests us some new readers and listeners. And I say listeners because all Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the poets themselves as part of our Penn Sound archive, writing.upenn.edu/pennsound. Today I'm joined here in Philadelphia in the Arts Cafe of the Kelly Writers House by Lynn Din, the Saigon-born poet whose most recent book of poems is Jam Alerts. And by Randall Couch, a poet, editor, critic, administrator, and teacher of poetry and poetics at Arcadia University. And by Erica Kaufman, who has had two books of poems published in 2007, Civilization Day and Sensory Impulse. Sensory is spelled with a C, as in censorious. Resides in Brooklyn and co-curates Belladonna and co-edits Belladonna Books. Welcome back, Randall and Lynn, and hello, Erica, and welcome to Philadelphia and to Poem Talk.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
Hi, Erica.
Our poem today is Ted Berrigan's Three Pages, which appeared in The Red Wagon, published in Chicago by the Yellow Press in 1976. Penn Sound's recording of this poem is from an episode of the radio show In the American Tree, which Lynn Hajinian and Kit Robinson hosted on KPFA Radio Berkeley in the late 1970s. In 1978, they had Ted Berrigan on, and toward the end of an hour, when they all realized there were just 2 minutes of airtime left, Berrigan said that perhaps he should read a poem that is the sum of all his work, a poem for the ages. And then he turned to and read our poem, which took just 44 seconds to read and may or may not be Berrigan's attempt at a summing up. What it is for sure is a list poem. Before we talk, let's have a listen. So here now is Ted Berrigan reading Three Pages.
It's called Three Pages. It's for Jack Cullum. 10 things I do every day. Play poker, drink beer, smoke pot, jack off, curse. By the waters of Manhattan, flower. Positive and negative. Go home, read, lunch, poems, hunker down, changes. Life goes by quite merrily, blue, no help wanted, hunting for the whale, and if the weather plays me fair, I'm happy every day. The white that drives clear, the heart attack, the Congressional Medal of Honor, a house in the country, not enough.
Erica, you've said that you love this poem. Maybe we'll start by just asking you to say why you love it so much.
Well, I think that part of the reason why I love this poem is what you were saying before about how Berrigan said that this was the sum of all his work, and it does feel that way to me, and it also feels like an amazing picture of New York and life in New York and poetry in New York.
So if someone were to come to you and say, well, Erica, you know New York and you know Berrigan, you know, what in sum is this saying about Berrigan's poetics?
He's moving from the I do this, I do that poem, and then opening it up into a more philosophical questioning of routine.
So the first half is an I do this, I do that poem, a list poem in the style of Frank O'Hara, and then it does something else at the end. Randall, how would you generalize about that two halves of the poem?
Well, what struck me about it is the sort of meandering nature of the first two-thirds of the poem. And the kind of beginning with the white that dries clear, the regimented flesh-left margin arrangement of four items which seem not part of his life but part of what he assumes the standard American life would be like, which he seems to be saying is inferior to this list that he's just given us of sort of bohemian pleasures.
And if the weather plays me fair, I'm happy every day. The white that drives clear, the heart attack, the Congressional Medal of Honor, a house in the country.
This is a list poem, and it begins 10 things I do every day, but I only counted 9. Let's count them together. Play poker is 1, drink beer, smoke pot, jack off, that's 4, curse is 5. Now, I'm going to take flower as a verb and make it six. Anybody agree with me?
It's plausible to me.
Plausible. A go home is seven. Read lunch poems is eight. Let's stop there. Go ahead.
Because it was interesting because in the way he performed it, he read those almost as if they were three activities. Read, lunch, and do poems.
Oh, okay. So that would get us to 12. And maybe Erica will tell us what the reference is.
That's
there.
O'Hara.
O'Hara, the great book of I Do This, I Do That, This Is the Way I Live My Life, first-generation New York poets thing, and Berrigan, second-generation. So read lunch poems, mm-hmm. Hunker down nine. Now, changes grammatically so that it doesn't seem to be part of the list. He's not saying my life will change. In fact, if anything, he doesn't seem to want that. So if we're counting, he does challenge us to count. Does anybody want to try to figure out what the 10th would be? Or is he just messing with us?
Well, I was playing with the notion that, in a way, the poem succeeds by always coming up short. I mean, it's called three pages, and it's printed on two. And at the end, the last line is not enough. So it's making some statement about insufficiency of one life view there. So I thought perhaps, in his formalist vein, he was looking at ways to embody disappointing the expectation of a fixed number.
I was also thinking that I would count not enough as being 10.
Lynn, any thoughts?
You know, it's obviously a city poem, like Erica has pointed out, but not necessarily New York City, any city poem, and a modern poem in a sense that, you know, we have all these activities, these impressions in a day that just that don't add up to anything, really. So it's a sort of a meandering, it's a kind of a walking poem, but a mental walking poem.
Mm. Yeah. On the Penn Sound website, there's also a reading in 81 of the sonnets. And in the introduction to that, he talks about coming to New York in the early 60s from Oklahoma to be a poet. And he didn't really know exactly what that meant, but he said he would just show up and do what poets do. And so if this is a summing up poem, I can't help but see a little bit of this analogy with the Psalm 137 by the Waters of Babylon, of the sort of exiled Israelites arriving in this big metropolis, and what they're doing are playing poker, drinking beer, smoking pot, etc. So that overlay was resonant for me as well in the poem, you know, that this is a kind of review of that move for him.
And here it's by the waters of Manhattan.
Yes.
So does anybody want to comment on that in all caps?
Well, by the waters of Manhattan is a reference to Reznikov.
Charles Reznikov,
his first novel.
So you have two literary references in this poem that I would say is a kind of, I don't want to have a job. I don't need a job because this is my job. And of course that novel takes place in Lower Manhattan. I love the way flower can be a verb following by the waters of Manhattan. Flower. If you grammatically put a comma after Manhattan, you get in a sense he's saying, Here, by the waters of Manhattan, flower, I flower. One of the things I'm going to do today is to flower.
By the waters of Manhattan, flower, positive and negative, go home, read, lunch, poems, hunker down, changes.
Berrigan was rather proud that he didn't really have a job for much of his life. I mean, he did have to teach some, but the fact that he could sort of not be bogged down and committed to one long-term job was something that he took great pride in, I think.
It certainly reminds me of Emily Dickinson's line, for occupation, this. What is her occupation? The very thing that you're reading, this. The thing that I'm doing, making a list of what I do, which is not doing anything. So I was going to ask you, Erica, whether you thought the three lines, life goes by quite merrily, blue, or maybe two of those, the first two, was ironic. It sounds like, from what you just said, that it's definitely not ironic. Life goes by quite merrily. I read lunch poems, I jack off, I play poker, and life goes on merrily.
I don't know that it's ironic. I'm tempted to read it as not being ironic.
And No Help Wanted,
right,
is a sign, a placard, turns around the usual, you know, you're an American boy, get a job,
mm-hmm.
to No Help Wanted, No Help Needed.
And what I took, at least, as the reference to that sort of great American obsession hunting for the whale, is he sort of equating that with his, you know,
think
occupation.
About the
Isn't
argument
that amazing?
That Ahab and Starbuck have.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Starbuck thinks of this as a job, as a profession. Ahab thinks, you've got to be kidding me.
Right.
We're going, this is what we do. there's something tremendously American about Ted Berrigan here. It's not simply a cousin to Ginsberg saying to his psychotherapist, I don't know, everybody thinks I'm ill because I don't want work, I don't want a job. It seems like Berrigan's going for the great symbolic American selfhood.
But then what happens with the next two lines and quotes, and if the weather plays me fair, I'm happy every day?
What do you do with that?
It reads like a folk song to me.
It does.
Did anybody find it as a allusion? I'm assuming this is a piece of his collage work here.
So that it's specifically from somewhere?
Yeah.
I tried and I couldn't find
Googled
anything.
Yeah.
I Googled.
Well, I kept thinking of, I thought of Bob Dylan saying, I'm just going to sit here by this river, and there is a river in this poem, and I'm just going to sit here and watch the river flow, which is another declaration of a 60s-style declaration, this is a little later, saying, I'm not going to do anything, watch me. So the folky part of it does make it seem very playful. So then we get four lines which are, as Randall suggested, left justified, and they seem to be another mini-list poem, a sort of a do-not list poem. Does anybody want to comment on these? The white that dries clear, the heart attack, the Congressional Medal of Honor, a house in the country. Lynn?
Well, there's some ambivalence here. This list is are things that he rejects, but it's kind of open-ended. You know, even if we had these things, they won't be enough, but not that they are undesirable in themselves, you know, because in a sense, nothing is enough.
If you sort of abstract those, the white that dries clear being sort of technological achievement and the heart attack being the work ethic and the Congressional Medal of Honor being patriotism and bravery and the house in the country being material success, it's kind of a list of the U.S. desiderata.
Absolutely. It sounds like the 50s becomes the 60s. He's saying, well, this is what you guys wanted, but we're different now. If it's that, isn't it a little obvious? Isn't it a bit of a cliche, a 60s cliche? Eric, I'm going to ask you, because you said you love this poem so much. Isn't it kind of easy?
I don't think it's easy because of the way that it moves from beginning to end. Well, I was thinking a lot about the title being three pages. And
yes, I hope you will explain this because I haven't a clue.
I don't really know. The notes to the collected poem suggest that it's transcribed words in response to three different silk screens by George Schneeman. So the way that I was thinking about it is the first page is after curse is where it ends. So 10 things I do every day, play poker, drink beer, smoke pot, jack off, curse. Second page, by the waters of Manhattan to changes. And then the third page would be life goes by quite merrily, blue, no help wanted.
So three pages is the what's left, the remnant of the composition of the thing on three different pages. It's mm-hmm. the only thing that's left. That's nice. And it's three movements.
Three movements, yeah.
Life goes by quite merrily, blue, no help wanted, hunting for the whale. And if the weather plays me fair, I'm happy every day.
For a poem that's so seemingly offhanded, it sure is a literary poem. It makes two references to, really three if you include Moby Dick, three references to classic antecedents. And also it's dedicated to a poet, Jack Colum. Lynn, do you have any idea why Jack gets credit here?
Well, I didn't know, so I called Jack a couple of days ago.
You actually called him?
I called him, yeah, just to ask him.
What did he say? What did you ask him?
Well, at first, he couldn't quite say, but he did. He did tell me that he, in 1966, he sent Ted Berrigan a self-published book of his called April, in which he wrote a poem every day. So maybe there's some connection here. But when was the sonnets published, by the way?
64. Yeah, 1964.
So it came after. So maybe So Berrigan was already a name, and Jack wasn't because this was a self-published book. So. So he thought that maybe they have a mutual interest in dailiness, is what he told me. Mm-hmm. That could be it. And And also this list thing.
Can you say something, or any of you, about the sense, the feeling we get as readers of this poem, created by the present tense quality of it, the sense of immediacy? It's sort of a simple question, because all of us who've experienced an O'Hara lunch poem, for instance, have had this sense. But how would you translate it? How would you explain it, either for this poem or for others?
Recently, there was a review of a Dale Smith poem written by Nicholas Manning. Nicholas Manning is only in his mid-20s. But he complained about Dale Smith, I do this, I do that approach, which he thinks is by now so stale and so tired. But it stopped me thinking about what would make a I do this, I do that poem successful.
Yes, so what did you think?
Well, I think the collage technique is the initial seduction, you know. You have to juxtapose to create a sort of a interesting texture of language. I think that's one hook to bring people in, and then you throw in bits of insights and aphorisms and sly jokes, you know. These are little nuggets that you throw in. But so you juxtapose the profundity with the kind of banality.
Device that allows you to put anything in. So that if in fact I'm writing about what's happening right now, there is no category that excludes, as long as it's literally right in front of you. I think of a great line from a wonderful poem, Redshift, simply this: there's a song, California Dreaming, but no, I won't do that. Now, no, I won't do that is present tense, but it also means, gee, my poem is going in the direction of the poem California Dreaming, but I don't want the poem to go there, so it won't, but that remains in the poem. This is controversial, or at least was at a certain point when the New York first generation New York poets came in. Now, Erica, you're can I call you a Barrickanite? You are occupying a space that's a cognate to that space. Can this be done? Do you do it? Do your friends do it? Can this generation of poets, what are we up to, the fourth generation New York poets? Is it valid? Is it a good aesthetic? Does it turn you on?
I love it personally, but I do not write in that mode.
But you think it's viable.
But I think it's viable. And what really works for me, especially about this poem, is I feel like the writer.
How so?
Like I become present in the poem.
Lynn, your thought on this question of the presence of the poem?
I want to raise the issue that when Berrigan wrote this, there were a lot of confessional poetry. And in a sense, this is a confessional poem without the drama. So, you know, his refusal to emphasize his own personal drama and anguish and conflicts is, I think, one of the appeals of a poem like this. You know, it was a way out of that sort of overheated, self-pitying kind of drama.
And he's also suggesting that psychic health can be derived from this disparate and dissipated life. And that, in fact, psychic illness comes from waiting around for the white to dry clear. That's the direct. That's how a poet gets a heart attack. That's how you get cut off short.
By the waters of Manhattan, flower, positive and negative. Go home, read lunch poems, hunker down, changes.
What about the fact that it doesn't? It refuses to build up any sort of lyrical momentum, you know what I'm saying? Because it's so fragmented, you know what I'm saying? It doesn't move the way, let's say, like an Ashbery poem or even a Frank O'Hara, you know what I'm saying?
Maybe I read it differently, but I saw the poem as beginning in a dailiness, and by the end it's opened up into a world situation, and it's gotten very intense because of the series of the four negative images that culminate in the not enough in all caps.
It begins modestly or false modestly by saying, I'm going to tell you about me, only me, and don't take this as a proselytizing it. It ends by talking about all of us, about American culture in particular, and about where he stands and how he's going to refuse largely.
Capitalism.
And
capitals.
The need for the house and the country and the second mortgage. In capitals. Before we get to the Gathering Paradise segment of our show, let me ask each of you to offer a final word on this poem, or maybe something more on what you get from it. Who wants to start?
Just thinking about what makes a successful list. I think, because that's a strategy that, I mean, I employ in my work. I think that you set up a pattern and then you upset it at some point. And, you know, the master of the list for me is Borges. He shows how interesting, how funny a list can be.
Erica, your final thought?
I wanted to share a quick quote from Jack Colum from the Nice to See You book, tribute to Ted Berrigan. Conversation with Ted is the title of the piece. Quote, Ron and I used to worry about the problem of continuity in poetry until we finally figured out when you say something else.
Wonderful. Would that Ron be Ron Padgett?
I would assume so, okay. Yeah.
Thank you. Randall?
Well, that feeds in nicely. In the interview that accompanies the reading in on the KPFA tape, Berrigan claims to be a formalist, and that when a few words occur to him that spark writing, he immediately looks for a formal idea to react against or follow through. And I think what makes this interesting as a list poem is to sort of hunt for evidences of his formal play in the way he organizes things. One thing in particular he mentioned was a kind of conceptual rhyme where he likes to mention something and then hold it in suspense and have it reappear later in the poem. And I think this is a lovely example of those kinds of rhymes.
That's nice. Thank you. I don't usually get a final word, but I thought I would add one. I found an interview with John Cage that Ted Berrigan did. It's fairly well known. It's really pieced together from tape-recorded interviews. I'm imagining Berrigan, quite an odd couple, really. I'm imagining Berrigan following Cage around during a visit to New York that Cage made at parties, in taxis, apartments. And here's a quick exchange from it. Cage says to Berrigan, "Do you know the Zen story of the mother who had just lost her only son? She is sitting by the side of the road weeping, and the monk comes along and asks her why she's weeping, and she says she has lost her only son. And so he hits her on the head and says, 'There, that'll give you something to cry about.' To which Berrigan says, 'Yes, somebody should have kicked that monk in the ass.'" Now, the whole interview strikes me as creating a kind of Cagean poetics for Berrigan, and if I read back into my reading of Berrigan, I begin to see a lot of Cage there. But this is a Cagean poetics with a kick-ass style, I would say. Berrigan is, you know, in some years very testosterone-driven. He throws his weight around, as it were, and he kicks ass. And I don't know if Cage's little Zen story was going in that direction, but I think when Berrigan said, "Kick that monk in the ass," Cage had to agree that that was the right approach. It's just that Cage wouldn't have been capable of doing it. We like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two of Gathering Paradise, a chance for several of us to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really poetically good, to hail, puff up, commend someone or something going on in the poetry world. So, Lynn, would you gather a little paradise for us?
Yes. I'd like to recommend a section in the new Jacketmagazine.com of new 20th century Turkish poetry. And I'll just quote a couple of sentences from the editor, Murat Nemit Nejat. He says that if one wants to grasp the underlying principle of 20th century Turkish poetry in one stroke, it is that it brings animism into the middle of our global universe. And then he said, not only trees or animals, but in this poetry, color, objects, things, natural processes are in dialogue with each other, weaving the endless patterns. So, you know, we're talking about Berrigan here, and if everything is alive, if everything has a spirit, has an anima, then nothing is banal.
Thank you, Lynn. Erica?
I've been loving David Trinidad's newest book. It's called The Late Show, and I wanted to share from the life of Joe Brainard, 1965. Moves to a new apartment, inspired by the color scheme of The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, paints the walls in various pastel shades, but when result disappoints him, moves again. And that's David Trinidad.
Well, that's all the kicking monks' asses we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writer's House at the University of Pennsylvania and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks to my guests, Lynn Dinh, Randall Couch, and Erica Kaufman, and to my co-producer, Mark Lindsay, and Poem Talk's assistant director and editor, Steve McLaughlin. And a grateful shout-out to Kit Robinson and Lynn Hajinian, who brought Berrigan and so many other poets into the studios of KPFA in the late 70s. This is Al Filreis, and I hope you'll join us again soon for another Poem Talk.